coup is put a hockey stick, but in the wrong side. So in part of my first, I was the first one to skate on the reflecting pond in front of the perimeter also, and very proud of this. Like I have a little movie, and I was the last one too. As by the time I left the pond and came back to my office, I got an email. In fact, everybody at PI got an email saying that this was not a place to go skating. So thank you, Richard. And Richard was mentioning all the lists of accomplishment. And I remembered the first time that Richard introduced me in a presentation. I was in Calgary around 1995 or 1996. I have a brother who's a mathematician, works at the Department of Mathematics over there. And I was going to see him and I said, oh, maybe I'll give a talk in Calgary. And he says, okay, I'll go and check if there are people doing quantum computing here. At the time, I didn't know that Richard kind of was there and everything. So he said, oh yeah, there's this guy, Richard Cleave. And my brother, and I said to my brother, I would talk about quantum error correction. And my brother warned me and he says, there is this guy, Richard Cleave, but he doesn't really believe what you're doing. So I went and kind of took all my arguments with me to be sure, and kind of it has paid off, because if I look at the progress that has been done in quantum error correction in the last 10 years, certainly the theory side has been pretty amazing. And what I would like is that Richard be skeptical about the experimental side of quantum error correction now, so that the progress in the next 10 years will be the same as the one we've seen in theory in the last 10 years. At that talk, by the way, I had my son, Patrick, who was 3 years old at the time, and he was at the back of the room with some transparency that I had left him so that he could play. And as the talk progressed, he was coming nearer and nearer to the front. And at the end, and he finished, he was giving my talk with me and kind of showing that errors indeed and kind of are occurring more and more often. So I hope that by the time I finish this, that I don't have the same problem today. I'm going to talk about error correction, and I don't think I have to introduce you why people are interested in quantum information, except to say something like, if we can manipulate information with the rules of quantum mechanics for certain tasks, it is incredibly more powerful than doing it with classical physics. And once we know this, we might ask the question of why don't we have quantum computers around us, and why can we kind of build them and go and do these tasks? And the reason is that it is, or it seems today, with what we know and what the technologies that we have, much more difficult to manipulate quantum information and then to manipulate classical information. And so some years ago, it was even believed that it might be impossible to do it. And part of the story of error correction is about this. Before I go further, I should mention the people who have helped me to prepare this talk. Martin Forêt and Osama Moussa, but also people of my group, Jonathan Baugh and Joseph Emerson, who are not part of my group, but faculty at ITC, who've done experiments. And when I talk about characterization of noise in a few minutes, that came through work that Joseph has started. And other students that have been in my group, I won't name all of them, as kind of my time is getting limited. But I also point out kind of other colleagues at IQC who are indeed kind of, and there I won't go and nominate all of them. And when I kind of put this together, I said maybe I should have a picture also of the people at Parameter have inspired me in the last 7 years, but then it becomes, oh, and you can turn around and see who are these people so I don't have to go and do this. So here's the plan of the talk. And when I was thinking about this talk, I thought, okay, there I go, either at IQC, but I would be at ITC, I would not give any background on quantum error correction, just go and dive in the experiment. But here at Parameter, there's many people who do not know much about error correction, so I was thinking that I will give some kind of introduction. And at the end, I have a set of transparencies. If I have to skip some of them as I go to the end, then I will just skip some of them, but I will give you some kind of background of how does quantum error correction works. And if you have understood this, and that there are experiments today related to this, then I think you've understood what the message I want to pass. So we'll talk a little bit about the need for quantum error correction, about elements that are needed for quantum error correction, characterizing noise, characterizing and demonstrating control of quantum system, and extracting entropy. So in there, I will kind of give one or two slides on some experiments that have been done and what we've learned from them. And so the good part about the part in here is that if you lose one experiment, don't understand the detail of them, then you can pass to the next one and understand the next one without having to know the detail of one in particular. Okay, so before even computers were built, or kind of when the beginning of the thoughts about building these devices came in, there were claims that they were already dead and people would not be able to kind of construct them and make them work. And two devil's advocates in that field were Rolf Landauer and Bill Unruh. And it is in that spirit that I started to work in the field of quantum information, of people saying, can we really build this device? And some of the arguments went that way. That is, if we have probably to do a certain gate, a certain operation on quantum computers, the probability goes like 1/-epsilon. If we do n of these gates, then probability of success should go down exponentially. And the whole idea of quantum information processing is to try to process information with an amount of resources, amount of effort, which is much, much less. But if the probability of doing these gates goes down exponentially, then we would not gain anything. And so people like Rolf Landauer and Bill Unruh were saying that on paper, these things are really helping you, but in practice, they won't. And so Rolf, who was a very critical of any kind of new technology, wrote this paper, Need for Critical Assessment, and says adventurous technological proposal of subjects to inadequate critical assessment. It is the proponents who kind of set up meetings and kind of makes all the kind of these great things of what's going to happen, but people are not critical enough. And part of his criticism was essentially that when we're thinking about quantum computing, or when he was thinking about quantum computing, he was thinking really of quantum computers as analog devices. We have a wave function. The idea of a computation is really kind of to start with a wave function, which is easy to access. Having this device called a quantum computer, which manipulates this wave function, make it move in a Hilbert space in some other direction, then make a measurement and getting magically an answer of something which is very hard to do classically. And he said, because it's a continuous movement of this wave function, this looks like an analog process. And if you look at your car, or you look at information processing device that we have today, there are less and less of these analog devices. And the reason is that they are harder to control. They are harder to make more reliable. When we go to the digital world, there are ways to do this called error correction. And this is what I'm going to talk about. But at the time, it was not believed that there was an analog or a quantum analog to classical error correction. And mainly because these devices were thought to be analog devices. So Landauer says, if we start to make many gates, then kind of the error accumulate and we don't know how to get rid of these errors which kind of creep in the computation. So at what scale these error comes in, and that's kind of model, very rough model of Bill Unruh. He suggested that the error would come at the scale of h bar over kdt. So if you're a theorist, you just kind of put this and you guys put h bar is equal to 1, kbt equal to 1, let's put t equal to 1, so one error, so it's not too bad, so we kind of should be okay if you cope with one error. But when you go to experiments, you go and put these numbers in there, and what you get on the time scale of this is 10^-9 seconds, which is rather short, which means that pretty much on kind of all the devices that we are thinking about today, noise should swarm there. And it turns out that if you look at few devices like nuclear or magnetic resonance, the noise comes in at the time scale, which is much longer than this, about 1 second. So I learned a little bit about this, and that's kind of part of what was motivated me. There's another part also motivated me. Anybody knows Bill Unruh knows that he's very argumentative. And so I was a postdoc of Bill some years ago, and I knew very well that if I would say white, he would say black. If I say black, he would say white. So quite often to argue with him, I would start with the inverse of my argument. And then he said, this is nonsense. And indeed, I was a perfect Bill. You've convinced me. So he wrote this paper, and then I decided to be the devil advocate. I said, I want to demolish this paper. And that's how I got involved in quantum error correction. So other comment on Landauer is that he said, thinking about quantum computers, unfortunately, we continue to see this contribution to quantum parallelism, which are correct and imaginative in their details. Anybody who knows, who have known Rolf Landauer, he was very, very critical about anything and anybody. But he makes a compliment like this. is very impressive. You know that there was really something behind quantum computation that he says that. But as soon as he says it, then he said there's a but. Do not even mention the need to control tolerance and noise, and that will be the story about quantum error correction. So it was on its way. In some cases, this literature go even further and simply describe the quantum mechanical mapping from state to state without even specifying apparatus needed to do this. But I had to put this coming to parameter. I'll check it. I think it was a paper by Seth Lloyd. Okay, so the answer came about error correction through something which is called the accuracy threshold, which says that if the noise is relatively well behaved, and I'll talk a little bit more about what does that mean, and the error rate is smaller than a certain amount, then noise is not a fundamental objection to quantum computation. So there, with some kind of assumption which we believe to be reasonable, I'll come back again about what does that mean, then we can take care of the noise. And that's what I want to spend about the next 10 minutes to explain to you how does this theorem comes about. So for the people in the audience who do a lot of quantum information computation, you can fall asleep for a few minutes because you know that story. So what is the story about error correction? Well, it came and got inspired by classical error correction, which is the idea of taking a bunch of devices which are not incredibly reliable, put them together, and make one super device which is much more reliable. That's the basic idea, putting resources together so that we get something at the end which behaves much better. And the question is, how can you do this? Underlying this is a desire, however, to do this with an amount of resources which doesn't go up too fast. And what do I mean by not too fast? It's not exponential that way. So if it would have to remain polynomial. So that the rule of the game is always to come back and think about how much resources do we need to go and do this. So, and this is the great influence from the computer scientists in the field, because they come back always to us physicists and say, it has to be efficient, it has to be efficient. And physicists in the history of quantum computing kind of missed this from time to time and then finally realized how important it is. So how does that work? Oh, I should have pointed out that one of the first work on error correction was done by Richard Anning, who was an engineer at Los Alamos. And in fact, he was working with one of these electric kind of IBM typewriters, computers. And he was trying to do a computation, and the device was kind of always screwing up and breaking before he would get to the answer. And he tried a couple of times and then suddenly he gave up. He moved, he went to AT&T. And about 3 years after he was at AT&T, he kind of started to write about error correction, and there's something which is well known for the people who know error correction. The Amming distance was coming from him doing this. So it came by hitting his head around the wall on devices which were not doing what he wanted, and he found a way out to make them do what he wanted. So here's, in very, very brief, how does classical error correction works. So the first element that we need to know, and at first we are thinking about digital information encoded in zeros and ones, and then we first need to know what is the noise model. So we can think about, if we have a strings of bits, that there is all kinds of possible error models. And we go and look and the world around us and says, does these noise models kind of correspond to what we have? And it turns out that most of the time, the noise that we have around us is rather benign. And I'm saying this because when you are thinking about noise model, you can always be kind of very bad. There's always noise model which can do things where your device will be completely useless. Think about having a devil who's always creeping, and before the noise is such that it doesn't matter when you compute, but when you just before you read it, it goes randomly and flipping some bits. There's nothing that you can do with it. So there's always the noise that you will defeat you. There's always an anniversary you can go and do something. And we all know this in some way, that at some point there are devices that can. But if noise is not as bad as that one, maybe sometime you can make things reliable. So here I'll make a simple assumption. Noise is independent from bit to bit. And then the probability of having the noise will be described by a bit, zero, which flips to a one, and a one flipping to a zero. And it's the same probability from zero to one to one to zero, just to make things simple. So this is the noise model. And so the basic idea of error correction is that to add redundancy. So here we'll do a very simple computation, or we could use it for communicate. You want to send information to somebody or just leave it in your device. We're going to encode a zero into a triplet of zero, a one into a triplet of one. And then you'll leave it there, and then suddenly, after a amount of time, you'll go and look at what you have. And sometimes you'll get the triplet of zero or the triplet of one, so you'll know what the information is. But sometimes one bit will be different than the others. And what you'll do then, you just take the majority of both. You'll look at the two of them and say, okay, there's only one zero here, then I'll flip it to a one, and then I'll assume it's the one, and then you'll go back. So what do you gain by doing this? Well, we started with an error rate, which was epsilon. And then you can look at this as, if this epsilon is small enough, there's only a probability of one bit which would flip, which would be proportional to epsilon. There's a probability of maybe two bits flipping, epsilon squared. So if this happens, that would mean that this would have come from here, two bit would have flipped, but this would go like epsilon squared. But if there's only one bit which flips, the term which is proportional to epsilon will be taken care of by going to the majority. So by doing this, what we do is that the effective error rate goes from epsilon to epsilon squared. And there's a constant which comes in front by how many times kind of these bad errors which you cannot correct comes in there. So when is this successful? Then the error correction procedure is successful when epsilon is smaller than, C epsilon squared is smaller than epsilon, or epsilon is smaller than 1 over C. So when you go and calculate this, then you can know now what is this threshold value is when you arrive to this. So what's the equivalent of a noise model for the quantum world? So we still have a bit flip, a zero, we could flip a zero, but there's another type of noise which corresponds to a phase flip. That is, if you have a state which will be alpha zero plus beta one, the initial state, it could flip to alpha zero minus beta one. Where is this coming from? So think about the generic evolution of a single two-level system with the rest of the universe, and I'll make the assumption then that the combined system of your two-level system and the rest of the universe behave unitarily. I will follow the string theorists who believe that the whole thing behaves unitarily, which always make me laugh when I hear about this information problem, paradox, and all this, because one in the lab, it's very, very hard to get the system behave unitarily. In fact, that's what I'm trying to do every day, getting nearer to this goal, the sacrosanct principle of the string theorists and gravity people. So I will make this assumption, foolishly enough, but if you do, what you can see is that if I take a generic state of my two-level system in the environment, make it evolve, I can rewrite this in this following form. And so it's easy to see how do I add this. If you add those two terms, these one will cancel and we'll have exactly zero and epsilon zero, and then same for all the other terms that comes in. And I rewrote it that way because if you look at it, it's a discrete sum of different effects. Different sum which correspond to not doing anything to the state, having a phase flip error, the Pauli Z error, or the Pauli X, which is a classical bit flip error, or the combination of Z and X together, which gives you a Y error. And so a generic evolution of a quantum state, okay, which correspond to the wave function moving some direction, can be thought as a discrete sum of different area. So that's where the discretization comes in the classical world. Sorry, the discretization comes in the quantum world, not in the classical world. So the second part is redundancy. How do we do the equivalent of copying? So the first idea would be, if we take a state alpha zero plus beta one, maybe we can just triple it, make it three, kind of starting with alpha zero plus beta one, and two extra degrees of freedom, which are in a given state, let's call it zero. Make a unitary transformation, which corresponded to the sum of three times alpha zero plus beta one, alpha zero plus beta one, alpha zero plus beta one. But you can show that this violates unitarity. So instead, what we're going to do is that we're going to transform basis and go into a different basis, and let's say a basis which is that form. And when I'll go to experiments, I'll go and explain why we want this particular form. But this is called the encoding. And you choose this encoding in such a way that the noise is not going to corrupt your quantum information. And this is very dependent on what is the noise that we have in that system. So once we have this encoding, then we let the noise comes in. And let's assume right now that we have only the noise corresponding to bit set. Then the state would come in that way. So we can go and measure these qubits and then decide it and take the majority. So if we go measure the qubits here, we're going to collapse in that side or that side. So we'll see a 0 or a 1. And then we'll destroy the quantum information. So we cannot do this. Instead, what we can do is, instead of measuring the bits, we can measure the difference of the bits. If you measure the difference of the bit, the difference of the bits is the same on this side and this side, so you're not going to collapse the wave function or the part of the quantum information which contains the alpha and the beta. So in that way, you can get around the problem of collapsing the wave function of the quantum information. So putting all of this together, you get what is called the theory of quantum error correction. I mentioned about this encoding. A generic evolution of a density matrix can be seen as a sum over these operators are called Krauss operator, which describe the noise. If you have no noise, the generic evolution would be rho with a u unitary and u dagger. But when noise comes in, then you have a sum of these operators. They could be unitary or they might not be. And then if you have this, then this is what you are trying to do. And there's a set of equations which tells you how does the encoding of the 0, the encoding of the 1, for example, how do they have to behave so they can be protected from the noise. And the basic idea is that the 0 and the 1, when they are mapped in their Hilbert space from the noise, have to remain orthogonal from each other. So that's the delta ij part of it. So the 0 and the 1 have always to be orthogonal. If not, you won't be able to keep the information. And that vector, the length of the 0 and the length of the 1 have to remain the same, and that's what the CAB comes in there. So there's a way of how to describe what this encoding has to look like once you've given the noise.
The operators, or is there a dependence on the basis as well?
The CAB are independent of IJ.
Okay, so it's property purely of the noise.
So it's independent of what I and J are in it, but it depends on what these operators are. So the little index here corresponds to depending on these things here, and the delta corresponds. And this is the connector delta, and this is matrix.
So the question is that you know the operators from the noise model, you know the CAB from that, and then you try to find the basis of logical states that will satisfy this equation.
You know what this is? And then this, you know what it is, and you try to find a CAD and some state here. So you try to find some state here so that when you take the inner product, you get a matrix of that form. Whatever CAD is, you don't really care what it is. Okay, so with all of this, we know how to take a state, encode it, and once it's encoded, you know how it is protected from noise that comes around. But as soon as people started to think about this, they said, but what happens if you start to kind of move the information and try to compute? How are you going to kind of, if you start to do this, you'll have errors that will be introduced when you try to kind of manipulate information. Also, when you start to encode the information, will you create errors when you do this? And how are you going to deal with this? And that led to a theory which is called fault tolerance error correction. And the basic idea there is to take a gate and to be sure that when you manipulate things between different encoded states, then the error that comes in don't kind of behave badly. That is that you can kind of, their behavior is under control. And what we have in mind in here is suppose that we do a gate which is called a control knot. Control knot is a gate which is, if this is 0, it is going to do nothing to the target bit. If this is a 1, it's going to flip it. So this is one of the gates that we use in quantum computation. If it turns out that there is a sign error, I should have put a z here, so e to the I theta in front of the one state in here that comes in here. if we have then a control knot in here, what happens is that this error gets double. It induces an error both on the control and on the target. And if you keep on doing this, then these errors are going to multiply. And if they multiply, then your error correcting code is not be able to cope with this. So there's a theory of how to deal with these behavior of different things. How to set up gates so that these errors don't propagate badly. And so I'm not going to explain this in more details, but just to tell you that there is a theory which takes care of this. So the difficulty of do this, it makes a code in a way to manipulate information, which is a little bit more complex. So how more complex? And let's go back to one qubit that we get. We encoded it in three a few minutes ago. And what was the impact of this was to change the epsilon, the error rate target, to something which looks like C epsilon squared. In a simple code that we had before, we had a value of C, which corresponds to how many times you can have bad error that comes in. Here, the C is going to become more complicated when we add default errors. So that's the only thing that happens. So the C will be bigger. So the threshold will become smaller to be able to do error to control the system. But if we go back to the probability of error here, if we have an error rate which is epsilon, the number of gates we can do reliably goes like at one of epsilon. If we have now something which is say epsilon squared, we'll go to C. Number of gates will go like C epsilon squared. But suppose that your computation takes more than one over C epsilon squared gate. What do you do? So the answer, at least in theory, one thing that you can do is that you take your qubits there and you re-encode them. And so if you do this, it's called concatenation. What you get to the next level is C to the 4, C to the 3. And you can see that if you are beyond the threshold where this is smaller than this part here, then you'll see that this will be smaller than this, and then it gets smaller and smaller and smaller as you increase the level of concatenation. So putting all of this together, then you get a value C, which is, what comes in this accuracy threshold in here. So the value comes here, correspond to, what is this value there, correspond to calculate this C in the accuracy threshold there that I've mentioned before. So the work of calculating this has, in the last 10 years, has improved dramatically. People wondering, going from really bad error function, I've put the number here in rather pale, and I should have put it even paler because we don't know exactly what this value of a threshold. This is not a universal constant. It depends on the code that you're using, the noise that you have, the technique that you are using, et cetera, et cetera. And Danielle is a person that's been working on this for many years. And very recently, there's a paper which compare very different gate kind of methods together. In fact, the one by Ali Farris, Gottesman, and Preskill, there's a method to calculate this threshold. And they look at different codes on this and values that they get very recently out of the press in February 2nd, 10 to the minus 4 is the value that they have. Maybe we can improve again in the future in kind of getting better and better value for these thresholds. My interest has gone in a slightly different way. Instead of trying to find a better threshold, I went back to think about what are the assumptions that we have for the accuracy threshold? And do they correspond to the kind of noise that we have in the world in which we live? And most of my work has been to try to understand this. And to do this, we have to go and kind of look at experiments and see what kind of noise and the different properties of these noise, of the noise. So what I want to do in the next kind of 20, 25 minutes is go through some of these elements that are ingredient for fault tolerance. Well, the first one I'll mention is that when you try to do fault tolerance, it is essential that you have parallel operation in your device. If you don't have parallel operation, you can kind of easily convince yourself that noise is always going to catch up with you. So once you know this, you have to find a device where you can do parallel operation. And I'm not going to talk anymore about this. What I'm going to talk about is, how do we know what the noise is? How do we characterize it? And give you example of simple models, places where we've done experiments to show and learn about the noise. Then I'll give you kind of a couple of devices where we have good control, good quorum control and implementation of these error correcting codes. And if I have the time at the end, I'll talk about how do we take noise or kind of the heat that comes in a device and extract it into something which is called algorithmic cooling. So I'll go one by one. So let's go now and see how do we characterize noise. I've already mentioned to you that if we start with a density matrix and the system doesn't evolve unitarily, our representation of the evolution is through what is called these cross operators. It is a sum over set of operations, and the only constraint of these operators is that the sum AK dagger AK is equal to one. So it can be very generic kind of behavior. And when we characterize the noise is an idea of having what these operators are. What I'm going to do is use a slightly different representation, which is called a chi representation, where we expand these things in terms of tensor product of Pauli operators. And you'll see in a few minutes why I'm going in that direction, because it's simpler to explain what we want to know about the noise. So in there, it's just representing those in terms of Pauli matrix, and then kind of the coefficient in front will be a function of the details of what these A's and A daggers are. The PKs are just tensor Pauli matrices, for example, X for the second one, Y for the second one, the unit for the third one, Z for the fourth one, et cetera. Okay, so if we look at this for one quantum bit, and we're looking at how many parameters do we need to characterize one qubit, one two-level system, which is evolving. Well, you remember probably your course of quantum mechanics that you need 3 degrees of freedom to do a unitary transformation. Like a generic unitary transformation would be of the form e to the I theta over 2 n dot sigma, the Pauli matrix. There's 2 degrees of freedom on the direction of n, okay, and then the angle theta. But once the system is not unitary anymore, how many parameters? And it turns out it's 12 of them. And you can really think about this of thinking about if you have a set of density matrix corresponding to the sphere and inside of the sphere, the ball. So all density matrix can be thought as this Brock sphere. A generic evolution would turn this into some kind of ellipse pointing in some direction. So if you look at parameters to describe this, you'll get to 12. Or another way to describe this is go through this chi matrix. So we have the initial density matrix, the final one, and then this matrix, which is 16 by 16. But there's 4 constraints which correspond to preservation of the trace that comes in there and the 12 parameters that comes in. So a single quantum bit needs 12 parameters. And the next thing that you need to know for the general rules is how many for n qubits. And you can go and find the amount, which is the 4 to the n matrix, so 4 to the 2n. But there's this constraint again, which comes in 4 to the n. So the number of parameter is 4 to the 2n. And this goes incredibly fast. So we have an experiment that we've done a year or two ago with n equal to 10 quantum bits. And if you go and calculate 4 to the 2n, 4 to the 20 is 2 to the 40. And if I don't make any mistake, it's about 1 trillion. So to find the noise, if we do experiments which last about 1 minute, then a trillion times 1 minute takes a long time. So I have a few of my students here, and I'm sure they have no delight of going and do this. So here's an example with n equal to 3 that was done by the group at MIT of David Corey. So that's what this kind of chi operator looks like. So that was the theory one of the experiment. And although it was a feat to really have patience and stamina to go and find this, once you have this, it's very hard to kind of analyze how good is that experiment. Yeah, you can see it looks like Manhattan. That skyscraper here is a little bit higher than kind of this one, which is not true here, and kind of, but it is very hard to go and kind of. N equal to 3. So for n equal to 3, 4 to the 6, 2 to the 12, it's about 5,000.
What is plotted against what?
It's like the sky matrix.
So it has two elements.
And what are you color coding?
I think the color coding is for your enjoyment, so to look at that there is as many of them and kind of trying to make the picture slightly less boring. So how do you go and characterize the noise? I can see I'm quickly running out of time. So out of these four of the two N parameters, there's much too many of them. How can you go and reduce it? And then, so you have to find a way to coarse grain them. And so what is the kind of coarse graining we would be interested in? And there I'm gonna put my skin into somebody who wants to do error correction. So we have error correcting codes which corrects for certain type of errors for certain kind of qubits. So an example would be correcting for one qubit error, two qubit error, three qubit error, independent if these errors are corresponding to so some X, some Y, or some Z errors, or independent of if kind of it happens on the first qubit, on the last qubit. So if we do this, how many parameters do we reduce these four to the n? We reduce it to n plus one. So we just need the number of probability of zero errors, probability of one error, probability of two errors, three errors, four errors, up to n. So can we do this? So the basic idea is to do a coarse grain. So we have all these incredible number of parameters, and then depending if we do different coarse graining, we would kind of get this kind of coarse graining, and what are coarse graining really? Is to symmetrize our system, is to implement a symmetrization of kind of implementing a symmetry. And the ideas of this that were kind of suggested by Palos and Hardy, and this is the direction that Joseph Emerson did, building on work from Richard Klee, Chris Benford, Joseph, and Etoile Levin. But all people were here some years ago. But they were interested in kind of randomizing the noise. And me, it was quite interesting when I learned about this. It is a good example of interaction between kind of some theoretician kind of having some ideas and experimentalists doing some other things. When I heard Richard first mentioning about randomizing thing, I said, well, like, you know, these computer science, they like to use these concepts, but me in my lab, randomization of things is the last thing I want. Like, I have enough random things happening under my control. I don't want to randomize. And this showed me that with a little bit of time, I kind of learned of being a little bit wiser and realizing that randomization sometimes is an incredibly powerful tool. And here is an example of this in that example here. So if you randomize this under a certain group, and so each, so here the idea of Chris Benford and Richard and Joseph et cetera was that these U will belong to SU2 cross N. So each qubit would be randomized one by one. And what they show is that you can replace this integral, complete randomization to a sum. So this is saying, oh wow, so maybe I can find this. If I don't have to do the integral, I have to do a sum. Maybe I can do this in a less amount of resources. And what they showed that is that if you do this, the C's now are part of what is called the Clifford group, which is can be understood as randomizing all the, around the Pauli group. So these C will become one X and Y and Z. And also after that, by the symplectic group, EI, X, Y, or Z. And the interesting thing about this is if we look at this chi matrix, which looks like a complete mess, in the previous slide, if you randomize over the Pauli group, what happens is that you are reducing this chi matrix in such a way that K is always equal to L. That is the off diagonal terms of this kind of get the average away and randomize. Averaging over the symplectic group, and if you look at these matrix, the importance of this is to, if you would have a noise which would be only X, it will transfer it to a new noise where X, Y, and Z appear with the same probability. Or if you would have X, Y, and Z appearing with three different probabilities, it will transform it to a new noise where X, Y, and Z will occur with the same probability, which is something like PX, the probability of X, probability of Y, plus probability of Z, divided by three. So there, you're again coarse graining, so that you don't care about which error is happening by doing this. And the last coarse graining that is being done is by symmetrizing. So if you randomly kind of manipulate your qubits one to the other, but the noise will affect all of them in the same way at the end.
So by all putting this together, then Joseph Emerson came with this, the idea of an algorithm which will go and pick up these coarse grain numbers one by one. And so the idea is, take your density matrix, kind of do the symmetric, the kind of randomization of the position of the qubit, do this Clifford group randomization, let the noise comes in, and then you do the inverse, and when you come out at the end, you get, you are able to extract what is the probability of 0, 1, 2, 3 qubits. It turns out that implementing this randomization with this Clifford group exactly would take you an exponential amount of resources if you want to do it exactly. But it showed that you could estimate it and with a finite bound, and the bound, the precision of this estimation doesn't depend on the number of elements in that group, but the sample that you are using. So all of this showed that you could do this with an amount of resources which didn't go too fast. So I'm looking at the time, and so what I can show very, very quickly is experiments where we've done this recently. Experiments which was done by this one by Manafort in an MR, where we have only 2 qubits, and then we went to implement these steps one by one and try to look at the noise. So the molecule that we use in liquid state NMR is chloroform, where we have 2 qubits. There's all this chloroform here, you can, this chlorine here you can forget about, as they have spin 3F, interact very weakly, and we don't see them essentially on the time scale of the experiments that we do. We have 2 qubits, they implement this with noise that they induce themselves, just to check, can we kind of, do we have enough control to go and find kind of the right values for probability of zero error, P0, probability of 1 error, probability of 2 error, probability, well, there's no 3 error when we use only 2 qubits. So by the noise they implemented, kind of, that they know very well, the target value here was 0, and they got 0.001, kind of, probability of 2 errors in that case, because the error is Z1, Z2, should be there all the time, got very, very good value, showed that we could understand very well what was happening. And slightly after Martin did his experiments, Combe, Ryan, did the same thing in solid state NMR with a different molecule, malonic acid, where we have 3 qubits, this carbon, this carbon, and this carbon. And then although there's hydrogen around, which could be used as qubits, there's something which is called kind of decoupling of these qubits that he used. So the, what he tried to show is that by this decoupling and by a scheme that he had, he would be able to see absolutely no evolution of these spins, which would be always coupled together. And what he found was that on the first step, his trial to do this, he realized that the probability of 0 error was 50%, probability of 1 error was 45%, 2 error was about 10%, so very far from what we had. And so we were all surprised why this was that bad. And finally, we realized that this decoupling that I mentioned was not strong enough in the way that we had set it up. And there was coupling which were coming up from kind of these qubits. He improved this, and we were able to go to a probability of error, which was 85% instead of 45. Not one as what we would like, but it is kind of difficulty of doing these experiments. So with this, we could not only kind of describe the noise in our system, but have an idea also to kind of troubleshoot when things were happening differently. We can also use these ideas to look if the noise is independent from qubit to qubit. And so by doing this, the red line is that if they would be, and the kind of little dot in there is kind of what we did the experiment. So if the error is independent for from qubit to qubit, the probability of 2 qubit error is related to the probability of each 1 qubit error. If the noise is not independent from qubit to qubit, then you would have a different relationship between two. In the case that we have, you can do this. And you could also go and look at for things like a non-Markovian noise in the system by doing something which is very similar in time instead of number of qubits.
But 10 more minutes.
I've mentioned to you how to characterize the noise on a system that we let evolve by themselves. There's also a way to characterize the noise when we implement some gates. And I'm not going to talk more about this. And instead, I'm going to go and talk about the implementation of some error correcting codes using 5 minutes. And then after that, I will take another 5 minutes to talk about cooling our system. So I mentioned about some error correcting code that you've seen already before. If we take a system like an MR, it turns out that the Z errors happen at a rate which is much faster than X or Y errors. So on the first step, you can go and correct for these errors. And this is kind of some of the things that I have done, in fact, quite some time ago, nearly 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, 10 years ago, wow. So although it's a very good example to show how kind of error correction works, but the idea, so that's why I'm going to go through. So the idea here is, let's take a state alpha 0 plus beta 1. We want to protect that state. Let's have 2 extra qubits in 0. And we have some noise in here, which will correspond to implementing some Z error, some the Pauli matrix Z, kind of randomly from one qubit to the other. So we can do this by hand, or we can let the natural noise come in and affect our system. So once we encode this, this is one of these control that I mentioned. So if we go through the first control knot, it will take the state alpha 0 plus beta 1 with the state 0, and is going to go to alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1. So when it is 0, doesn't do anything for a second qubit, but when it is 1, it flips it. Same thing for the third qubit, so it will give me the state alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1. And then we do a rotation around the y-axis. And if you do this, then we can rewrite this in the state plus or minus, which corresponds to 0 plus or minus 1. So we get the state alpha plus 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 beta minus minus minus. The reason why I wrote it in this basis is that if we have a Z error on the state plus, it gives me the state which is minus. And if I have the state minus here, it gives me the state plus. So if I have error on the first qubit, I will have something which is of this form, alpha minus plus 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 beta minus minus. Same thing there on the second qubit or the error of the qubit. If we implement the inverse, what you find is that the state will become of this form here, with the last 3 qubits containing information about which qubit have been affected. So if we go and read the last 3 qubits, we know that the first qubit, no error comes in. Here, the error was on the first qubit, the error was on the second qubit, the error was on the third qubit. In the last 2 cases, the state has not been modified, but in this case here, it has. So there's an error correction procedure that can be put in, which will take the information on the last 2 qubits and make a transformation on the first qubit. And if you do this, you can show that the error rate, instead of being gamma, which would be probability of 1 error, will go, or probability of success, instead of being 1 minus something like gamma, will go like 1 minus 3 gamma squared, because if we have 2 errors, then you'll see that this state is going to start scramble, and the error correction procedure doesn't work. So this is the curve that we've done. So the result of the experiments in green is if we implement the error by hand, and red is if we don't implement error. So we see the fidelity gives you kind of 0 state, which are orthogonal if we implement the state that did the error by hand. And then we recover the information if we implement the error correction. But really interestingly is the curve, which is of this form here. And the demonstration of error correction here is a demonstration that this curve is much flatter. And it comes in because the term, first term that comes in is not 1 minus gamma, which would happen if you have 1 error, but of the form 1 minus gamma squared with a coefficient that comes in. So the probability of errors is kind of diminished by doing this process. So building on this, people have been able to kind of implement different kind of error correcting codes. And so here's one which is done by the Iontrap group a few years ago. Very slightly different diagram, but same kind of code to protect for types of errors that they implement. And here's the plot, not the fidelity, but for some reason in Boulder, they like infidelity. So the curve here corresponds if you don't do the error correction, so the intensity increases. And for the particle diagram here, they started with the state with the spin down, or let's say the state which is zero. So the error correcting procedure could correct this very, very well. Once they get superposition of different state of zeros and one, you can see that at the beginning it works very well, and then suddenly it kind of takes off. Is when the probability of two errors comes in, then it's not as good. Same thing when you have a different superposition of state with a little bit more of mixture between, or superposition of plus and minus, then you get a curve which is similar. So other devices and quantum information start to have the control today to implement these ideas.
So the idea, the implementation of error correction that you just explained is the same thing as the randomization protocol that you just said before, is it?
Completely the same. So the first thing you want to know the noise. Once you know the noise, you can go and implement an error correcting code, which will kind of advise.
So randomization tells you which noise model is
appropriate. Exactly.
So here's another example of a error correcting code. This is one which corrects not for only phase flip, but bit flip also, for a combination of bit flip and phase flip. So there you cannot use the 3-bit code that I mentioned before, but you need a 5-qubit error correcting code in order to do this. So this is again something which has been done some time in the past. So for the quantum information people who have been very patient, one little note of something that we're doing with that code right now is that you can purify what is called magic states by doing this, by looking at the decoding, which is the inverse of the encoding, when you take the circuit and go this way, and by having a tensor product of states on each of those, which would not be exactly of that form but some imperfection, by decoding through the 5-bit error correcting codes, you can end up with one copy which is much more pure, or kind of much better than the other one. And this is experiments that we are doing right now, and I hope that to get results in not too long. I have a few more minutes, so I'm not going to talk more about encoding and kind of a demonstration of encoding. What I would like to do is to go to the next step of error correction, which is once we know the noise, we can decide to have error correcting codes. We can implement them. And once we do the error correction procedure, we arrive at the end, and then we recover the information, and we have extra qubit in the SLS which contain the noise of our system. If we want to do the error correction a second time, we'll have to go and purify some of the qubits. And how do we go and do this? And here's an example of how this can be done. So the idea is, suppose that we have three states, three systems with three different states. It is possible to concentrate the purification, the purity of three qubits in one of them at the expense of making two of them kind of more noisy. Now we can make these two qubits here interact with the noise, with the bath, to get two more qubits, or the information, or kind of the purity of two more qubits with slightly lower temperature, and then do the process again. And by doing this, we can show that we can go and purify and bring back one of the qubit to a state which becomes kind of nearer and nearer to kind of purity. So this is a way out to exchange in a controlled way, kind of with a bath, in order to go and purify qubits which had been corrupted, for example, through error correction. Another way to think about this is think about it as a Maxwell demon. This is exactly a version of this. So we have these random balls going kind of around in the room, and then kind of we say, by kind of manipulating the states of these balls, we can make one cooler at the expense of kind of putting the other one warmer. And then kind of if we go and play with a bath which is on the side, we can kind of do this process again and again, so that one of the molecule that we have, or one of the qubit that we have, goes and boosts its polarization. So mathematics of how to do this. So we have three quantum bits, states which are pretty much mixed, density matrix e to the minus beta h, and beta is very small. So we can expand it in terms of tensor product. So z1 means z1 tensor 1 tensor 1, z2 means 1 tensor z2 tensor 1. If you look at the density matrix, it's of this form here. So the number 3 is here because the top left corner of these three matrix add. But when we look at the second one, there's one of these elements coming from one of these three operators will have a minus. So you have 1 plus 1 minus 1. You get this, you get this. Here you have 2 minus. Then you have a plus again, and you have minus. So if you take the trace over two of these quantum bits, the second and the third one, what you'll get back is a matrix which will have that form here. Indeed, you add these three numbers, you'll get 4 divided by 8. It's 1/2, so that'll give you 1/2 of beta omega, which is what fits in here. Now, if you look at this density matrix and know that if you do the trace, you get the state for the first qubit. If you flip these two states here, then instead of subtracting here, you will be adding it. So you, instead of having 3 plus 1 plus 1 minus 1, you have 3 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, you'll get 6 over 8. Then you will increase the polarization of this, which is increasing the polarization. Or the equivalent of this is to flip the state 0, 1, 1 with 1, 0, 0, which is what we're doing. So why is this working? It's because if 0 is the ground state, this state, okay, gives you purity for the first qubit because it's in 0. But it's more probable, it's less probable than that state because two of them have higher energy. That state here gives you less purity for the first qubit, but it's more probable, which corresponds to the minus and the plus. By flipping these two states of this one here, then you increase the polarization. And then you can do this again and again until you get to the polarization that you want. So experiments that we've been doing at IQC in the last year, the last 2 years, is to do exactly this. So we go back to the malonic acid that we have here. And it turns out that one of these hydrogen here can couple to the bath at will. And it relax very fast. And we can decouple it, as I mentioned a little bit before, not perfectly, but good enough for what we want to do. So we can decouple it from the bath when we want. We can put it in contact or not. So what we've done is get rid of the polarization and formation completely on all the three carbons, and then kind of bring it back to interaction with the bath. So first with this hydrogen, so we transfer these little gates here correspond to a swap. So we take the information on the hydrogen, bring in the carbon in the middle. Then we do a next gate, which is transferring the information of this carbon to the one on the left. While we do this, this hydrogen here gets repolarized because it's interacting with the bath. Once this is done, we can start the process doing this again. And then we can then put the information on the second carbon, which is there. Then doing it a third time. And then make this gate, which transferred the states 100 and 011. If we do this, then what we get is that ideally we should get 1.5 of the polarization. But when we do it in practice, a little bit less. So what we see here is the spectrum of corresponding to the step here, polarization of the first carbon, transferring it to the carbon number 2, and then do it the same thing, transferring repolarization of the carbon in the middle, passing it to the carbon number 2, and then finally do the majority voting to kind of bring the polarization on the carbon 1 as much as possible. One fun thing is to do this process that I've just explained here and do it again and again and again and again. Ideally, we should go to a polarization of 2. Noise in our system did not allow us to do this, but enough to show in principle that these ideas would work. And this is one of the elements which is essential for error correction, is to be able to take some of the corrupted information in some of these ancillas, reset them to 0, to be able to go into error correction again. I've run out of time, so which is a good thing because I'm there at the conclusion. So what I've mentioned to you is the importance for error correction in doing quantum information processing. I gave you a very brief overview of how do we go and get knowledge of the noise, give you a technique at least for certain questions that you can ask for the noise, like what is the probability of having 0, 1, 2, 3 errors, how to go and do this and do this efficiently. I gave you example of some of the implementation of relatively good control, quantum control on small number of qubits, so that we have this element there for system that we have around us. Ability to extract entropy is what I showed in the last 3 or 4 minutes. Oh, parallel operation, in things like NMR, this is what we have. So the recent experiments have demonstrated that these elements individually, we can have them and show these step one by one. And what's left to be done is kind of pull all of them together to demonstrate error correction and many rounds of them. Definitely, we're very far from having a field which is kind of at the end of its lifetime. We're at the beginning of experimental error correction. I'm sure that in the years to come, there will be a lot more exciting things that will be coming. Thank you.
You tried to beat a lot of people here. And so when you're building this redundancy into the system to get a quantum error code algorithm, and for example, if you in practice, if you try to encrypt thousand bits, you need to maintain to enter the 18 qubits in coherence. It grows rapidly, so the exponential time the system gets out of hand very quickly in practice. Can you beat this?
So, in theory, the answer is yes. That's exactly the spirit of the threshold theorem, saying that if, and the important thing there is that what are the assumptions here? The assumption is that the noise is the same as you increase the size of your system. So the decurrence rate doesn't change. Let's assume that the noise is independent from quantum bit to quantum bit, which in the device that we have is a not a perfect assumption, but a reasonable one.
The per qubit decoherence rate doesn't change.
Yeah. But do we understand?
What did I say?
You just said the decoherence rate doesn't change.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So just want to add one quick question. Do we understand at a fundamental level the meaning of quantum decoherence in a quantum system? Because this, I mean, that's a fundamental question.
So I'm not sure what at the fundamental level means.
Can you beat it?
The answer is yes, I believe we can beat it. And again, this is exactly the idea of quantum error correction. It tells us that as long as this decoherence is not nasty like the one I mentioned earlier at the beginning of this talk, that it goes and changes as you change the number of qubits or things like this. As long as, for example, that we would be independent from qubit to qubit, and that we have an amount of qubits which is reasonable, like for pure decoherence, we need three times roughly this amount of qubits to add the right error correction code, then the theorem tells us, yes, we should be able to beat decoherence with an amount of resources which doesn't go exponentially. So when I look at this sentence here, it answers exactly your question. That is, the fact that there's decoherence, which is what I mean by imperfection of the device, is nothing. And decoherence is a very, very example of this. It's not a fundamental objection for quantum computing, but it's, we can find a way to beat this. There's a theory. Then we have to put it in practice. On the small system that we have, the theory seems to fit relatively well, but I agree with you that the real proof will be when we have a relatively large quantum computer, which can do something that we can do classically where we use error correction.
So the noise characterization method that you described looks like it would be a powerful spectroscopic tool for fundamental studies of what's really happening in a, you know, in a, you do spectroscopy of something that's a little bit more complicated than the hydrogen atom, and you have non-radiative decay between, you have a complicated level structure and you want to know exactly what's going on. Do you think it could be used like that? It would be precise enough that you could actually use quantum information to extract that kind of, you know.
So I would hope that. Now, if I look at pure spectroscopy that people have been using, most often people have some blob of something and they shine something and then just look what's coming out at the end. this would mean that not only you would like to shine something, but you would have to manipulate whatever is happening in there. And in order to be able to do this, you need to understand very well the Hamiltonian of the system that you want to control. So we cannot do error correction blindly without knowing how to control the system. So on the usual spectroscopy, it might not work, but there might be some specific application where you know very well your molecule, but you want to see some extra transition somewhere.
So the randomization is still dependent on what the particular system is, the particular qubit system, say.
Yes, well, you have to be able to control the system. So the way you do the randomization is that you control your system by making it do this or this or this. For example, when we wanted to have, if the probability of the error XYZ is, would be different when we go to there, how do we do this? We apply certain gates to your system. You do the operation again by a different gate. You do the system, the experiment again with a third gate, and then you sum the three of them, and then you get an average of these things. And kind of every experiment is done in a slightly different way, in a controlled way, so that the average is, will give you a fair idea of the average of error per gate. So there could be ways. If you ask me right now, I don't know how to do this, but there could be.
What would give me the idea is that because you're learning about the noise that you don't know in that system, right? In a sense too. So it is actually.
Yeah, you don't.
There's something that you don't know in there that you're getting information about.
But it does assume that you have a relatively high control of the system that you have, and it gets affected by the outside. This you don't know very well, and you don't want to know.
Let's have just one more question. One more part. Well, you've already asked the question.
Yeah, sir.
So,
my question was following on from Eric's question. So, you could also ask. I don't know if it would have followed on in the same direction, but I was a little confused about the relation, as you described it in your answer, between the characterization of the noise and the error correction. So in the specific example of the error correction that you told us, it seemed like you weren't using any sophisticated characterization of the noise. You were just using the fact, basically, that, like Danielle said, it's independent roughly from one qubit to the other. So is there a hope that when you come to build a more realistic computer, you'll characterize the noise and you'll fine-tune the error correction better to do something better than what you showed?
So maybe I skipped when I went to the implementing of the error correcting codes, but there was a pretty well-defined noise model, like in the example I gave where I said there were phase errors. So in here, I made the assumption that there were phase errors and they were independent from qubit to qubit. Right. So this is a very strict characterization of the noise.
But when you did the laboratory experiments, what assumption had you made on the error correction? On the error, the nature of the error?
When we did this?
It was just a bit step and no more?
It was a sine flip. And the error correcting code corrects only for sine flips. In fact, one of the interesting things is that maybe you can use error correcting code to know something about the noise. Suppose that you have bit flips, then you know that this thing is not going to correct. So the slope here should not be one, but it should be something proportional to the number of bit flips that you have. So you can use error correcting codes to do the other way around. But if you want to really implement error correcting code, you should know the noise. And I'll go back to one transparent a little earlier. The way that you design your code, the way you design your code is by knowing what the noise is. So these things are related in the one-to-one.
So if you assumed independence of the different noises, then there would only be whatever it was, 12 parameters to characterize the noise. And then once you had those, you could design the error correction.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so in view of the time, I think Raymond, there are more questions than I think Raymond can stick around. A while and ask them, hopefully. So let's thank Ray.